This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
Well, in the middle of Israel's current political uncertainty, a major development, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been indicted, which means he's going to have to stand trial for bribery and corruption. For this, we will turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
So it was a massive day yesterday because we had Gantz, the leader of the Blue and White Party, saying to the president, or at least the night before, saying that he could not present a majority in the Knesset, so that he does not have a way forward to make a government. So it looks like Israel is going to go forward to a third election sometime in March, if something crazy doesn't happen. But then shortly thereafter, we had the Attorney General come out and announce that he is going to indict the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on a couple of charges, including bribery, which is the hardest of these charges. We've discussed this quite a lot before, or at least some before. And this is he believes, the Attorney General does, that the Prime Minister has been acting as a criminal in three separate cases. One of them is bribery. Now, shortly after that, the Prime Minister came out of his house and addressed the public, and he said that he does not intend to step down while this trial is going on. You had people across the other side of the aisle, political spectrum, I should say, that want him to resign. He is the first prime minister to have pending charges against him and still be in office and still acting in that capacity. And so you had the leader of Benny Gantz and that saying, it's time for you to resign, get out of here. But Mr. Netanyahu is not going anywhere. He doesn't have to resign by law until the charges are formally settled. They aren't formally settled yet. You just have the Attorney General saying that he is indicted and that this is going to go to trial.
He says he's not leaving. What is the reaction? I know that there's a lot of celebration among those who really want to see him out of office and have been fighting for this for some time. What is the reaction among his supporters? How fatalistic are they?
Not at all. That's what's crazy about this. There was a mass pro-Netanyahu protest outside the Prime Minister's residence last night. If you read anything from English-speaking media in Israel, barring Israel Hayom, they're the only one I can find these days that isn't against Netanyahu, you would think that he's got to step down. The whole world
right.
has fallen, you know, and he's democracy is the fate of Israeli democracy is at stake if he doesn't step down. But really, what's interesting about this is that Likud supporters aren't really fazed by this at all. You do have one inside Likud that said, hey, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring now for leadership of the party. But the base is not going to be deterred by this whatsoever, because they see, as Netanyahu sees, a very unfair process mm-hmm. by the Attorney General and the police department to target him specifically with charges that they don't charge anybody else with. And this is what Mr. Netanyahu said as he addressed the public last night. He said, I deeply respect the justice system in Israel, but you have to be blind not to see that something bad is happening to police investigators and the prosecution. We're seeing an attempted coup by the police with false accusations against him. Then later he said, the public has lost trust in these institutions. It's a process that's taken place over many years. This is selective enforcement on steroids. It's enforcement just for me. And so you listen to those quotes, and it sounds directly like what's happening over in the United States.
Right.
Selective enforcement, a coup that's trying to get rid of a quite popular prime minister.
Well, that's exactly the point that Mr. Stephen Fleury was making in the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this morning, that it really is uncanny how similar the story unfolding here is to what's happening in America. The radical left attacking this leader that they don't like, doing anything that they can to remove him from power. We've talked before about just the substance of the allegations against Benjamin Netanyahu, and in your view, you said maybe you could summarize basically that there just isn't a whole lot here, that certainly not enough to warrant ousting him from office.
Right. So the big thing that would remove him from office is if he got actually convicted of bribery. This is a term that everybody understands. But what is interesting about this is this would be the first time that somebody has been convicted of bribery for receiving the favor of favorable press coverage. That's what it's coming down to. This is what Melanie Phillips, this is what Carolyn Glick said about the charges. She said, then of course there is the substance of the charges themselves. The charge that Netanyahu accepted a bribe is based on an invented notion that positive media coverage of a politician is bribery. The notion that press coverage can be considered bribery exists nowhere in the democratic world. No prosecutor in the world has ever indicted or investigated a politician or media organization of having committed bribery involving the provision of positive coverage. So that's what they've got him for, apparently, that he was meant to receive positive coverage. You look across the political spectrum over the media here in Israel, he doesn't get favorable coverage at all. So you can see how he was willing to go after that. But this is obviously, as Mr. Netanyahu said, selective prosecution. And I think the Israeli public sees it as such. And I think that we'll go to a third election. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Israeli public actually swing harder for Netanyahu after this indictment rather than before, because they are aware of the left-wing media bias that exists in this country to a great extent.
So another similarity with what's happening in the United States, that this process has, in a sense, exposed just how radical the enemies of this administration are.
Yeah, certainly. And I think you have to look at the democratic process that's going to play out here. It doesn't matter with this next election. It will be largely a vote on Mr. Netanyahu, as it has been already. But now you've got all the cards on the table. The media, the attorney general, and even the police department don't like Netanyahu. Everybody knows it. And the people are going to come out and vote and declare whether they think Netanyahu has done crimes that are worthy of him leaving office.
Maybe you could just let us know how you're viewing this in terms of prophecy.
Well, I think what's interesting about this is, as time goes on, it doesn't matter whether he leaves or whether he stays. The people that believe he was unfairly treated are going to get angry. And if he leaves and if he stays, the people that believe he should go would be very angry as well. Mm. You're looking at a very divided nation here in Israel, regardless of the outcome of this. And these divisions are going to stay. And I think that's prophetically significant in terms of Israel and we talk about the coming civil war in America, but it looks like Israel here being the state of Judah, is going to experience something similar to that, because there is this vehement fighting of Israelis against Israelis that's being exposed through this.
And where would you send people for more information, Brent?
I think people should go ahead and listen to The Trumpet Daily today by Mr. Stephen Fleury. Just his program from today, the first 15 minutes cover this, and he puts it in context, especially in comparing it to what's going on in the United States.
Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. I do want to mention another one of our programs here on Trumpet Radio. Brent Noctegal isn't just a panelist on Trumpet Hour. He also hosts his own program called Watch Jerusalem. It's a weekly program that brings news and archaeology from a biblical perspective. Brent is there on location in Jerusalem to give you the latest, the most important developments happening on the ground and emerging from beneath the ground in archaeology. Watch Jerusalem. It educates and inspires with this vision of Jerusalem's past, its present, its future. On the program he gave earlier this week, Brent looked at these ongoing protests in Lebanon and Iraq and talked about what Bible prophecy says the outcome is going to be for these nations. You can tune into next week's show for more news on this volatile region and learn more about the stunning archaeological finds that support biblical history. This is the place on earth where history and prophecy come alive. So listen to Watch Jerusalem. You can listen to it at kpcg.fm or at the Listen tab on thetrumpet.com, or you can go to watchjerusalem.co.il and get even more from Brent and from the staff that we have over there helping us. Well, we spoke last week about the evidence of the scale of China's detainment of Uyghur Muslims. And a trove of leaked documents out of China this week gives a look at what is happening to these people that Chinese leaders consider enemies of the state. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this was a trove of 403 pages that were leaked to the New York Times just the day after we had our conversation last week. And this leak happened by a person who says he or she is a member of the Chinese political establishment, so likely a fairly high-ranking member of the Chinese Communist Party. And the documents are particularly incriminating for Chinese leader Xi Jinping. There's really quite a lot to unpack in this massive trove of documents, but some of the main takeaways are that Xi specifically told Chinese authorities to use, quote, organs of dictatorship to control the Muslims. He also told them to, quote, show absolutely no mercy in removing the toxicity of religious extremism. And then these documents show that Xi and his comrades are accomplishing this, not with a targeted campaign that kind of goes specifically after individuals that they have reason to believe are dangerous, but instead they're using indiscriminate methods to fill up these concentration camps. So that was one revelation that kind of contradicts what the Chinese had told the world about their camps. For the first few years, China denied that these camps even existed, and then they said, well, yes, they do exist, but they're a positive development, and we only go after people with known terrorist leanings. But these new revelations now show us that all you have to do is be a Uyghur Muslim, and that's enough to wind up in one of these prisons or camps. Another revelation from the leaks is that Xi thinks the repression of the Uyghurs is valuable as a broader indication to other kind of potentially threatening parts of the Chinese population. So whether that's other Muslims, the Hui Muslims there in the center part of the country, the Tibetans, even the Hong Kongers, pretty much any minority group that could threaten social stability. He believes that what's happening there could serve as kind of an indication, a scare tactic, mm-hmm. I guess, which is chilling. And then the last revelation I'll mention is about some of the specific scripting that Xi and the CCP have given to the authorities to use with students who have left Xinjiang and then returned to find that one of their family members, usually their father, is detained. So they have specific scripting to basically convince these students that having a family member taken away by the CCP is a positive development, mm-hmm. and something that they should be grateful for. The quote says, "Treasure this chance for free education that the party and government has provided to thoroughly eradicate erroneous thinking, mm-hmm. and also learn Chinese and job skills. This offers a great foundation for a happy life for your family." So that's amazing. I have no love for the tenets of Islam, but I think that what the Chinese Communist Party is doing here is just absolutely chilling, about as diabolical as it gets. And the whole report really gives us more insight, I think, into how terrifying the whole Chinese Communist Party is.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. We talk a lot about just how God is, say, exposing the radical left within America, that he wanted to, really a major reason he brought Donald Trump to power was so that some of this corruption that was inherent within the United States would come out. We see a similar process unfolding in Britain as well. We're going to talk in the second half about how this is kind of coming out within Israel. And if you just think about it from God's perspective and just wanting to help us to understand just how flawed human governments are, at a time when you see within the West a certain amount of sympathy and enthusiasm for the way that China governs, you see this among among the more liberal elements or the more leftist elements within the West, where they're actually looking to China as somewhat of a model for the way that we want to conduct our own business. This gives you a sense of just how dangerous it is to think that way. And it seems like God really does want us to see, get a good hard look at really what's going on there.
I think that's a really, that's an excellent point to make. And it reminds me of a poll I saw earlier this week that was published. It was a poll of young people in Britain. I think they were 16 to 24 years old. And it showed that 50% of them had never heard of Stalin. 70% had never heard of Mao Zedong. And so I think that part of the reason why young people are enamored of socialism and communism and have some of those leanings is they have no idea just how barbaric some of the attempts at creating a communist utopia, so to speak, have been. To have not even heard of Stalin or Mao Zedong, that's utterly shocking, because these are some of the men who are responsible for more deaths of human beings than any other men in history. So it's it is just like a gaping void in the public education system.
So just looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, the Bible talks about the times of the Gentiles being the period, the era that's going to succeed that of Anglo-American dominance that has taken that has really governed the world for centuries now. This gives us a picture of just maybe what the times of the Gentiles, just how ugly those are going to get.
That's right. Yeah, I think this gives us a chilling preview of what's going to soon go worldwide. Right now, this is happening in a remote part of China, but the Bible does say that these times of the Gentiles are you know, going to begin very soon. And in basically, Mr. Gerald Fleury, the editor-in-chief of The Trumpet, has written quite a lot about the times of the Gentiles, and he explains that while the term Gentile can mean most any non-Israelite people, in end time prophecy, it generally refers to two main blocks. One centers around Germany, and one centers around Russia and China. So really, when we look at these horrors happening in Xinjiang and just how ruthless Xi Jinping is becoming, I think that is a preview of the kind of barbarity that we can expect to go worldwide in the years ahead.
Well, we do appreciate you bringing that story to us, Jeremiah. Hopefully we can write some of that up for the website, maybe even the print edition in the future. Well, there is a terrific crisis unfolding in Mexico between drug cartels and a beleaguered government. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is probably one of the biggest underreported stories in America right now. There's actually an article on the Federalist this week titled "The Most Important News Story Isn't Impeachment, It's Crisis in Mexico." It's a catchy title. It's definitely hard to separate those two stories and the fact that the reason the Democrats are so opposed to President Trump and trying to do whatever they can to oust him out of office is largely because of their opposition to his policies regarding Mexico. But this Wednesday, actually, the Los Angeles Times published a pretty extensive expose of the attempts of drug cartels to take over the avocado industry in Michoacán. That's a state in Mexico directly west of the capital city. It's the heart of the Mexican avocado industry. Which is about, they export $2 to $3 billion worth of avocados to the United States each year. So a huge industry down there. But this shows this attempt to take over the avocado industry is that these cartels that basically run this state are not only deeply involved in the drug trade. That's how they became so powerful. But they've now taking over, like I said, routine farming operations of avocados. There's states in Mexico where the drug cartels run the gold mines. There's states in Mexico where they set the prices at the supermarket, where they impose their own cargo taxes on the highways, where they charge their own business taxes. Even in Mexico City, the capital, you've got like bars and restaurants that pay a certain amount of tax to the government and then a completely separate tax to the cartels.
Wow.
You get up closer north towards Texas and like Tamaulipas, and the cartels, they pretty much run it's like a human trafficking ring, but like you hear all the illegal immigrants coming through here, and most of these immigrants are from Central America, but they get through Mexico by paying or offering to carry drugs for cartel agents. So they run the smuggling routes, they run the supermarkets, they run many of the gold mines, many of the highway taxes. And so this is evolving beyond just a drug trafficking organization to like these violent criminal syndicates that just run the government of huge parts of the country.
So for those in Mexico who are experiencing this scale of corruption and the government really just unable to gain control over these organizations, what kind of effects does this create? What sort of a position does this put the people of Mexico in? What might happen next?
Right. Well, the fact that drug cartels are running the drug industry has been the case for decades. But this development of them becoming so powerful that they're taking over the farming industry and the manufacturing industry and the supermarkets is a new trend. And it's basically putting especially southern Mexico, pushing it towards the same position that Central America is already in. The violence and the cartel influence in Central America over their governments is much stronger now than it is in Mexico. And that's the primary driver of why so many Central Americans from Honduras and Guatemala and Belize are fleeing their countries, trying to get through Mexico into the United States. And so if these cartels take over the industry and start acting more like they do in South America, you'll have the whole southern half of Mexico continuing to spread north, have the same sorts of like human rights abuses you're seeing in Central America, which is obviously horrible if you live in southern Mexico. But it's also going to make the U.S. migrant crisis exponentially worse. Right now you're looking at Central Americans trying to come through Mexico into the United States. But as these cartels take over Mexico, you could actually see the Mexicans themselves trying to come here. In that article I mentioned from the Federalist, it says, if you thought the border crisis was bad last year, wait until hundreds of thousands of families in Michoacan and Tamaulipas decide to flee cartels and seek asylum in the United States. And then towards the end of the article, he says that when they do, the border crisis that we've been dealing with for the past year will seem insignificant, a prelude to a much larger and intractable crisis for which there is no easy fix. Hmm. So this is some pretty dramatic language of just how bad the migrant crisis will get if you've actually got Mexicans themselves fleeing their country en masse instead of just trying to help Central Americans get through their country into the United States so they don't have to deal with them.
Where would you send people for more prophetic context on this story, Andrew?
We have an article we can put in the show notes by editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, entitled Where America's Race Riots Are Leading. There's a pretty hefty section in the article where he's going through a prophecy in Deuteronomy 28, verse 52, that says, "And he shall besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down." This is a prophecy directed at the end time descendants of ancient Israel, which is the United States and Britain primarily. But Mr. Fuller goes through here. He said, for many years, Mr. Armstrong focused on the first half of that verse that says you will be besieged in all your gates, to show about foreign powers taking over sea gates and besieging America economically. But the verse is really kind of like a two-fisted punch, in that while all that's happening with foreign nations besieging the U.S. economy, the high and fenced walls that America trusted in come down. Any points that that's mainly referring to the U.S. southern border, There's much more concern for migrants fleeing corrupt governments, or even working for cartels and being corrupt themselves, coming in through the southern border than there is the northern border. And so he really makes the point in here that America's southern border crisis is prophesied. It's prophesied in Deuteronomy 28 and verse 52, where it talks about these problems with people coming in through the breaches and the high and fenced walls that America trusted in so much.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. We'll put a link to that that article by Gerald Fleury, where America's race riots are leading, as well as a Key of David program that he gave called Southern Border Crisis Prophesied, in the show notes for today's program. In Sweden, for some time, there has been a rise in gang violence. To learn why and what the causes are, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is almost an incredible unreported story of just some dramatic changes in Swedish society. So this story is about explosions on the streets of a modern, Western, rich, prosperous country. You go back to 2017, and we have no statistics for how many explosions there were in Sweden, because, I mean, why count improvised explosive device explosions in Sweden? I mean, in Baghdad, yes, but Sweden, surely you wouldn't have anything. Well, 2018, it became pretty clear we did need to keep count. And that figure was 160 explosions. And then this year, just in the first 6 months, we hit around 100 explosions. Different authorities cite slightly different figures. But it's clear that we're seeing an uptick in these kind of explosions. And they're not necessarily small explosions either. The biggest one of the whole year was in July. It was in a university town in Limpkoping. Probably butchered that. But it was an explosion that destroyed two residential buildings and damaged more than 250 apartments. So that's a pretty massive blast. It's gotten to the point that in one of the towns in Switzerland, the authorities have basically issued a warning saying, you know, if you're out after dark, keep an eye out for explosives. This is a hazard for people coming back home from a night out now. It's just been a really surprising story. And it's something that's having a big impact on Sweden. At the core of this is kind of this discussion of, well, who's behind it? Now, the government isn't issuing figures on exactly who is carrying out these attacks, but there's a whole load of circumstantial bits of evidence that tell you exactly who, that you put them all together, it's very clear who's behind it. And this is leading to some pretty big changes in Sweden. So Sweden had a massive influx in migrants in 2015, 160,000 migrants. In a country of 10 million, that's big. You know, you're looking at somewhere more than 1% of the population. And that's when this started to take off. They've also had a problem with gun violence, and we do have more stats about that. And it's the same kind of criminal gangs that are involved in these explosions and the gun violence. And according to one Swedish newspaper, 9 out of 10 perpetrators of gang shootings are either first or second generation migrants. So this kicked in after the migrant crisis came in. Gun violence is predominantly migrant. You then compare that to Norway, that's just next door. So Sweden had 45 fatal shootings over the period of a year. Over the same period, Norway had 3. So this one country that's had this massive migration and has had a whole lot of shootings. Norway, that's outside of the EU, didn't have this same migration, had a whole lot less. So it really does, it seems pretty clear that you've got this. Oh, and then a lot of the locations where these explosions go off are in areas that have a lot of migrants. So you're seeing the migrant crisis cause some real problems now in Sweden, with just this problem that you wouldn't even think would be an issue in a first world country.
So what has tended to happen in other nations that have suffered these kinds of curses because of migrants coming in, you have authorities that are basically trying to find a way to deal with it without really labeling the problem. As you said, they're keeping the details hush-hush. But it gets out. There's enough evidence there that people can see what the real cause of this is. What sort of political effects is this happening within Sweden? As we've seen in other countries where you have a hardening of attitudes against migrants and a certain increase in far-right sentiment, do you have a similar situation playing out here?
Absolutely. Sweden's right at the leading edge, I think, of this trend. The Sweden Democrats are kind of a fringe right-wing party that was pretty insignificant until at least the last 10, 15 years or so. And at this point, they're pretty much neck and neck with the main left-wing party of being the most popular country in Sweden, most popular political party in Sweden. I think one poll put them 0.25% away from being the number one most popular political party in Sweden. And also, this is after the mainstream parties have adjusted. You know, this has been so bad in Sweden that things like, even things like the Green parties have participated in crackdowns on migrants, in closing Sweden's borders. You know, the mainstream parties have been forced to take some steps. But even with those steps taken, people are still saying this is not enough. And it's undermining trust in the government. It's undermining trust in all of the authority figures. It's undermining trust in the media because people don't want to talk about it. And you're seeing this big surge towards this fringe right-wing party. And this is a trend that just ties into so many critical prophecies that we're watching. One place, good place to go to get more information about this is an article I wrote in the spring called Clash of Civilizations, Real or Racist. And what this article talks about is you've got a couple of different prophecies in the Bible. You've got one, you've got prophecies that talk about Europe developing a strongman, developing more authoritarian leadership, developing more Catholic-centered type government and Christian-type government. And we've talked, you know, this Revelation chapter 17 talks about some of these prophecies. So that's one prophecy. And then also there's prophecies in Daniel chapter 11 that describe a clash between a European Christian civilization and a King of the South, Islamic-led civilization led by Iran. And so with this increasing violence in Europe, it's driving people to go to the far right, to go to these more authoritarian parties, to embrace a Christian identity that until recently they were shedding, and it's driving this conflict with Iran. So you can really see how this trend, or with Islam, so you can really see how this trend ties right in with the whole prophetic overview and a whole range of different prophecies. And that article, Clash of Civilizations, Real or Racist, will explain how this trend ties in with all of those different prophecies.
Well, we do appreciate that very much, Richard. You are listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Trump administration's big pro-Israel announcement this week, America's fraying security alliance with South Korea, and more. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Earlier this week, the Trump administration made a bold announcement that had a lot of Israelis celebrating, and it struck a significant blow to efforts to persecute the Jewish state. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it's really interesting, the timing of this decision by the United States State Department. This was something that has been worked on for over a year that the State Department was looking into with their lawyers, alongside some Israelis as well, to try and get the background on whether or not it's legal for Israelis to have settlements inside the West Bank. This is territory that was conquered from Jordan, who was occupying it, you could say, from 1948 through to 1967. Jordan never actually had a formal annexation of that territory. So they were there first, the Jordanians, and then the Israelis won that territory in a defensive war. And ever since that time, we've had an ongoing saga about whether or not it's legal for Israelis to live there, to settle there, or not. And there has been prevailing U.S. the position from the United States has changed over time. I believe back in the 1970s, it was the Carter administration that did say that it was illegal. That was overturned by the next, by the Reagan administration a few years later, saying that it was not illegal. And by and large, that has kind of continued. It did continue through the next administrations in the United States, saying that settlements there weren't illegal. But they just decided not really to talk about it and release too many official statements. Now, that changed with President Obama. In the final month that he was in power, people can remember him going to the United Nations, or at least Kerry going to the United Nations, and then the United States deciding to abstain from a critical resolution that was actually introduced in cohort with the United States. So they wanted this to come around. They were trying to get somebody else to introduce this measure, but it declared that settlements and Israeli settlements, including in the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and also East Jerusalem, that any Israeli settlement there was illegal. This was considered a parting shot by the Obama administration against Israel. And this is what has been effectively overturned by this ruling by the State Department, of course, by President Trump as well. This is what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said. I believe this was Tuesday or Wednesday. He said this, quote, "After carefully studying all sides of the legal debate, this administration agrees with President Reagan. The establishment of Israeli civilian settlements in the West Bank is not per se inconsistent with international law." And so there you have it. This administration, and by coming out and saying this, they're obviously saying it's okay for Israel to be there, an attempt to erase what Obama did, and also an attempt to hit back at the Europeans, I suppose, right, as well.
Yeah, well, we were just talking about this move that they made only last week about making sure that anything that was produced in the West Bank settlements was labeled a settlement, that it was essentially telling European consumers that this was coming from one of these contested areas. And so in this case, you have the United States basically saying the opposite of that, you said that this was overturning something or essentially batting down those efforts by the Obama administration. But really, this is going further than the United States or any other nation has before on this subject, right?
Yes and no. I mean, it probably is slightly stronger than what Reagan said. But I would say at least nations on the planet, like administrations on the planet today, current governments, yes, this is more pro-Israel, you could say, than any other government on the planet. And especially considering what the EU just said, I mean, they based their whole discussion about why these settlements needed to say, why their products needed to be labeled as settlements, because the EU deems them illegal. And so they wanted everybody else to know that they were illegal. And so this kind of effectively overturns that in terms of public opinion, at least putting out another voice there saying that you might read settlement if you get this EU product, but no, the United States doesn't believe that these are illegal. And the United States said that they were going to hit back at Europe for that action, perhaps in part. This is moving towards that. Now, Israelis are wondering whether this is announcing that the United States is going to back a full annexation of the West Bank by Israel. Part of the West Bank has been said that the Prime Minister wants to annex, that being in the Jordan Valley, but not all the West Bank just yet. But there are strong calls from Israelis right now to strike while the iron's hot, while we have the United States' favor, and see if we can push for a full annexation of the West Bank, saying that it's not only okay to live there, but this is going to be Israeli territory.
So it's interesting the way that this relationship between these two continues to deepen, and in this case, very obviously in disagreement with just about all the rest of the world, that you see this kind of this unification deepening and isolation at the same time, in a sense. And maybe you could just put all of this in a prophetic context for us.
Yeah, so this is, as you say, quite odd, the United States relationship with Israel, even in terms of historic relationship with Israel. President Trump has done a lot of things for Israel, given them the Golan Heights, accepted that that's Israeli territory, moved the embassy to Jerusalem, struck down a lot of measures against the Palestinian Authority as well for funding of terrorists. And so this is just another bit of icing on the cake to show that we have a really strong relationship, a strong alliance between these two nations. And this is something that did take place anciently. In terms of ancient Israel and ancient Judah, they were two separate kingdoms for a time. And under a certain king, Jeroboam II, which Mr. Flurry, our editor-in-chief, has likened President Trump to, there was a strong alliance with the southern kingdom of Judah. And of course, the northern kingdom of Israel today is made up by Ephraim and Manasseh, is made up by United States and the United Kingdom. And so we see this alliance brewing again and coming to the fore again between the ancient northern tribes of Israel, led by the United States today, and this nation of Judah. They are friends once again. It's destined not to stay that way, but here we have this alliance coming together right at the end. And that, again, does fulfill Bible prophecy. If people want to read up about this alliance and how God is working through Mr. Trump in this alliance with Israel, even, and what he's doing with Mr. Trump throughout the United States, they can read Mr. Flurry's article, Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily.
Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. We do have an article up on thetrumpet.com right now, Pompeo, Israeli Settlements Not Illegal. Go check that out. We'll also put a link to Gerald Flurry's article, Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily, as Brent just mentioned, on the show notes for today's program. America has maintained a strong presence in Asia since World War II with several strong allies, but these relationships are being strained by China's growing power. This week we saw this trend play out in America's relationship with South Korea. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, much of the tension here between the U.S. and South Korea centers on America's desire for South Korea to pay more for the soldiers that that America has stationed in South Korea. We've got about 28,500 troops there. And last year, U.S. President Trump convinced South Korea to increase its yearly payment by about 8%, which brought it to $923 million that the South paid for 2019. But now President Trump says that amount needs to be quintupled for 2020. He says the protection that the U.S. gives to South Korea is worth $5 billion. He says South Korea is wealthy, so that's how much they should be paying. So that's it's a massive increase that comes on the heels of what was already, you know, not an insignificant increase last year. And the South is saying this is far beyond what's reasonable. It's far beyond what they can afford. And then another factor here is the Trump administration's attempt to make a deal with North Korea. That's a very high priority for President Trump. And this week, as part of those efforts, the Trump administration indefinitely suspended its annual joint air exercises with South Korea. So that was something that the North really welcomed, but it was deeply troubling to many in South Korea. And then kind of a disconcerting twist also came into this story this week when the defense ministers of South Korea and China met, and they agreed to try to deepen their cooperation. So that was on Sunday when that meeting happens. And I think that, you know, should really serve as an indication of just how rankled the South is with the U.S. over these demands for payment increase and over its appeasement of North Korea. And then on Tuesday, talks between the U.S. and South Korea collapsed without any agreement over what the payment would be. So there was a report yesterday that America is already threatening to possibly withdraw one of its brigades. That could be up to 4,000 soldiers. That's unconfirmed at this point. But if that is true, that would show just how quickly this security alliance could come undone.
Could you just put this in the larger context of what we're seeing from the United States in terms of its presence in Asia and then how this is playing into China's strategy?
Sure, yeah. This we see almost a perfect mirror of this also happening in Japan. Japan pays about $2 billion for the 40,000 troops that America has stationed there, but President Trump wants that to be quadrupled to $8 billion. The Japanese are every bit as upset as the South Koreans are by these demands of an increase. And then China would love to see the U.S. out of both of those countries. Really, America is there largely to kind of check China and Russia to try to keep the waterways open there in the South China Sea and East China Sea. And the Russians and Chinese would love nothing more than to see those security alliances come apart. And I think that what we saw with that meeting this week between South Korea and China with their defense ministers, that shows that the Chinese would also be ecstatic to take America's place as kind of the security partner for either or both of these nations. And in the context of Bible prophecy, this is all very significant, because prophecy does discuss an Asian conglomeration of nations that will form in our modern day. You can read about that in Daniel and Ezekiel and Revelation especially. And it shows that Russia and China will be the lead nations, but that other nations, including Korea and Japan, will be a part of that bloc. So when you combine those prophecies with other prophecies showing that the U.S.'s power on the world stage will decline, I think it's easy to see that the days are numbered for the U.S.-Japan alliance and the U.S.-South Korea alliance.
Donald Trump is a businessman, obviously, but he's looking at these situations. It seems like the way he's talking about it is more from economic constraints than it is any specific strategic interests that are governing these kinds of decisions. But the reality is that the United States is kind of at its limits, having the resources to be able to maintain the kind of presence that it has in Asia.
That's true. It's economically, I think it makes total sense for President Trump to be kind of threatening to withdraw these troops, because it is incredibly expensive. Although keeping them stationed there is not necessarily more expensive than if they were in Virginia or something like that. So it does make some sense, and the U.S. is overextended in many ways. And he ran on a platform that was somewhat isolationist. You know, America first, we need to stop caring so much about every other nation around the world. But if you keep history in mind, particularly with Japan, I think you see that it's worth whatever it costs to contain that military machine. So it can't be simply an economic question. You have to factor in history and military questions. But for anyone who would like to better understand these prophecies and just these trends that are happening, I would strongly encourage them to read The Prophesied Prince of Russia. That's a powerful booklet by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. And we can have a link to that. It goes into great depth about all those prophecies.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. Over to Europe now. Headlines continue to show a rise in anti-Semitism within the continent. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, and that new survey shows that a quarter of Europeans hold anti-Semitic views. That was the survey published yesterday from the Anti-Defamation League. And basically, they asked 14 different European countries, or people from 14 different European countries, questions like, well, you know, is Jewish power oppressing the world of business? Do Jews still talk too much about the Holocaust? Are Jews more loyal to the state of Israel than to the nations they live in? Do Jews have too much? Do you believe that Jews are just kind of these very powerful behind the scenes? And they got quite high levels of response. In Ukraine, 72% said they believe Jews held too much power in the business world. In Poland, that figure was just over 50%. And the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt, he said it's deeply concerning that approximately one in four Europeans harbor the typical the types of anti-Semitic beliefs that have endured since before the Holocaust. He called the survey a powerful wake-up call and warned that unless action is taken, broad swaths of Europeans will embrace anti-Semitic ideas. Now, I think these kind of figures or these kind of surveys would be easier to dismiss if they were just surveys, if this was kind of like the only news of anti-Semitism that we were having. Maybe you could just kind of say, oh, yeah, well, yeah, there are some people that don't like Jews, and that's not great, but that's the way it is. But then when you look at the stats for much more serious, deadly attacks against Jews, they're also all going in the wrong direction. And you've got a very dangerous trend underway, especially in Europe. And just some of the stats, anti-Semitic acts in France were up 74% in 2018 compared to 2017. In the US, they doubled. Germany, they're up 20%. Violent attacks in Germany, up 60%. The UK just keeps setting new records for the largest number of anti-Semitic attacks just over the last 3 years. And then You had in Paris, a Holocaust survivor, I think that was 2018, being murdered in her own apartment in an anti-Semitic attack, Jewish widow being murdered the year before, four killed in 2015, an attack in kosher supermarkets. And I think what's most revealing is the way Jews are responding, just the way that Jews are getting out of a lot of Europe, especially France, this trend of Jews moving out of France. And I wrote on this a few months ago, and one of the biggest things that stood out to me from writing that article was just watching this interview of some French Jews. They'd moved from France and they'd moved to Israel. And I can't remember exactly the town that they'd moved to, but it was one of the towns that's within long range missile shot from the Gaza Strip. And occasionally you'd have a rocket from Hamas land there. So they're in this town within reach of Hamas, and they're raving about how much safer they feel now that they're in Israel. And they're just talking about, you know, this is fantastic. Our kids can go outside and play and we don't need to worry about them being attacked, or if they come home late from school on the bus, that there's not going to be some kind of an incident. And I think that response just shows the climate of fear that's been building. And then, of course, you've got in the UK where you've got a major political party with an election underway that very senior leaders have said some of these pretty worrying anti-Semitic statements and allowed that to continue inside their party as a mainstreaming of these kind of anti-Semitic sentiments.
Yeah, quite extraordinary to see the attitudes of those Jews who are facing that kind of persecution, that kind of hostility within those European countries. We do appreciate that. We'll put a link to an article that we have going up on thetrumpet.com on this subject. A survey, a quarter of Europeans anti-Semitic. And also Richard wrote an article on this subject quite recently that was in our print edition. We'll put a link to that as well, that gives the prophetic importance of this. It really is a very significant subject that reveals quite a lot about the influence of the devil in the world today, and just how much he is influencing minds. And this really is a reflection of that, quite extraordinary reflection of that, and also of Europe's future. We appreciate that, Richard. We're going to finish with a telling speech from former U.S. President Barack Obama. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, last Friday, Barack Obama gave a speech at the Democratic Alliance in Washington, D.C., and he told Democratic donors that presidential candidates should be pragmatic if they wanted to be elected. Specifically, he said, this is a country that is still less revolutionary than it is interested in improvement. Even as we push the envelope, we must be bold in our vision. We also have to be rooted in reality. The average American doesn't think we have to completely tear down the system and remake it. And at this point, it's important to note that he didn't say anything during the speech that Democratic candidates shouldn't be trying to tear down the system and remake it.
Right.
And he also specifically noted that he's not talking to Democratic activists. He said that's their job, to poke and prod and text and inspire and motivate. He's specifically addressing presidential candidates. He says they may not be electable if they get too radical in their rhetoric regarding healthcare and immigration specifically. And so that's a really revealing, it's a really revealing speech in light of how President Obama ran his campaign. 2008, he specifically told the nation, I believe marriage is between one man and one woman. I'm against gay marriage. That's a quote. And then after his administration pushed really hard for homosexual weddings, his campaign manager finally admitted that. He's like, oh, well, said he's been for that for since at least 1996. But we advised him to downplay that position because African-American Christians are pretty opposed to homosexuality. Similar story with socialism. We've covered on our website extensively Mr. Obama's past association with socialist and Marxist figures, and yet he really downplayed that in his campaign because he knew that, at least in 2008, the average American didn't want a socialist president. Today, things are starting to change, where you've got at the current Democratic lineup a man who's an open, self-avowed socialist, and another man who's actually in a homosexual marriage. But we'll definitely put America Under Attack by our editor-in-chief in the show notes. That booklet goes through Bible prophecies about Antiochus and identifies Barack Obama as a type of Antiochus, because Antiochus, he's this ancient Hellenistic king who came to power by flatteries before betraying the Jewish people and erecting an idol in his likeness in the temple in Jerusalem. And the book makes the point that an Antiochus figure is someone who pretends they're something they're not. You come to power through deceit, you come to power through lies, you come to power through flatteries. A lot of the radical leftists today are much more honest about the fact that they're radical leftists. But the transformative effect that the Obama administration had on this nation was largely because he pretended he was far less radical than he actually was.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Edward Albee. If you're willing to fail interestingly, you tend to succeed interestingly. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.